Okay, let's start again. Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the Information Service here in Geneva. Today is Friday, 9th of January, 2026. You may have seen that the UN flag at the office here is being flown half-mast today as a sign of solidarity for the victims of the terrible fire that claimed so many lives and made so many wounded people in Tramontana during the end of the year period. We join, we participate in the mourning the mourning day that the Swiss government has declared for today, and we really would like to express again all the solidarity and our condolences for the victims and our solidarity for their families and for the wounded ones. So that is why the half-mast flag is flowing today. I like now to start the briefing with a couple of points that concerns the situation in Sudan. Jens is here to tell us about this terrible anniversary, if we can call it like that, of 1,000 days of war in this torn country. And then we will hear from Ricardo about the situation of the children in this terrible conflict. So I'll start with Jens now. Thank you.
Thank you, Alessandra, and good morning, everyone. Also, on behalf of OCHA, I wish to express our condolences and sympathies with the victims, survivors, family, friends from so many countries who were struck, were hit, and bereaved over the new year here in Tramontana, in Switzerland. Having said that, let me just read the note that I have on the situation in Sudan. Today, the 9th of January 2026, marks 1,000 days since the start of the war in Sudan. 1,000 days of civilians paying the price for a war they did not choose. Nearly 34 million people need humanitarian support, and the scale of suffering is staggering. The entire region suffers from the spillover of the crisis. It bears repeating, Sudan is the largest displacement crisis in the world. 9.3 million people are uprooted inside the country, and more than 4.3 million have fled across borders, placing immense strain on neighboring countries. At the same time, large-scale population movements have been recorded in Khartoum, where people return to a capital ravaged by the war and littered with explosive hazards. Fighting continues across multiple fronts. In Kordofan, sieges have cut off the towns of Kadugli and Diling, restricting food, healthcare, and access to farms and markets. In Darfur, fighting on the ground and drone attacks from the sky continue, and we have seen long-range strikes on civilian infrastructure far beyond the front lines. Famine has been confirmed in El Fasher and Kadugli, with at least 20 other areas at risk. More than 21 million people are currently estimated to be acutely food insecure across the country. Horrifying reports continue to emerge of alleged violations of international law committed during the Rapid Support Forces takeover of El Fasher in late October, including mass killings. Women are bearing the heaviest burden. Sexual violence and abuse is rampant, and nearly 12 million people, mostly women and girls, are at risk of gender-based violence. Female-headed households are now three times more likely to be food insecure. Three quarters of these households report not having enough to eat. Hunger is becoming increasingly gendered. The health system in Sudan is also collapsing. Less than half of health facilities are fully functional, with significantly lower coverage in areas of active conflict, where it is needed the most. Cholera has been reported in all 18 states in Sudan, with over 72,000 suspected cases last year alone. In West Kordofan and Al Jazeera states, women report giving birth in overcrowded shelters, in schools, and on the move without clean water, light, or medical support. Humanitarians are delivering where we can. Nearly 19 million people were reached in 2025, with local and women-led organizations leading from the front. These groups are often the first and sometimes the only responders in hard-to-reach and high-risk areas, and they are facing growing threats to their safety. More than 125 humanitarian workers have been killed since April 2023, and access remains dangerous, inconsistent, and politically constrained. Funding for the response, as elsewhere, is falling short. Only 36% of our $4.2 billion appeal last year was funded. Cuts in financial support have forced an even tighter prioritization of the response in 2026 Humanitarian Needs and Response Plan. Partners aim to assist some 20 million people out of the nearly 34 million people estimated to require humanitarian support in Sudan. $2.9 billion is required to implement this plan, which is in fact 70% of last year's asks, only 70% of what we asked last year. This reduction reflects the realities of the current funding environment, not of the level of needs on the ground. 1,000 days is nearly half the last world war. And today, our call is urgent. First, an immediate cessation of hostilities and real steps towards a lasting peace. Second, adherence to international humanitarian law with access facilitated across conflict lines and protection of civilians, including aid workers and civilian infrastructure. And third, a renewed push on funding with particular emphasis on supporting local networks, women-led organizations, and national partners who remain front and center of this response. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jens. Ricardo.
Thank you, Alessandra. Good morning, everyone. Just before I start, I echo the words of Jens on behalf of UNICEF, of our deepest condolences and sentiments to all the victims, families, friends, all those impacted by the tragedy that happened over the new year in Carmontana. So let me start, and I will try not to repeat too many messages that Jens delivered from OCHA, because obviously there's a lot of cross-cutting between our agencies and the work that we're doing on the ground. But from a UNICEF standpoint, focusing on children, today also marks a very grim milestone, 1,000 days since war erupted in Sudan, 1,000 days of agony for millions of children across the country. Let me be direct. For the children of Sudan, the world is 1,000 days late. Since April 2023, Sudan has become perhaps the largest and most devastating humanitarian crisis in the world. More than 33 million people, two-thirds of the population, now need urgent humanitarian assistance. Half of them are children. Let me put some numbers into perspective. More than 5 million children have been forced from their homes. That is the equivalent of 5,000 children displaced every single day since this conflict began. Many have been displaced not once, but repeatedly, with violence following them wherever they flee. Children continue to be killed and injured. Just this week, 8 children were reportedly killed in an attack in Al-Obeid, North Kordofan. Famine has been confirmed in Al-Fashir and Kadugli, with 20 additional areas at risk across Greater Darfur and Greater Kordofan. An estimated 21 million people face acute food insecurity this year. Many of them are children. In North Darfur, the epicenter of Sudan's malnutrition emergency, nearly 85,000 children are suffering with severe acute malnutrition and were treated between January and November last year. That is one child every 6 minutes. Across Sudan, measles and other vaccine-preventable diseases are resurging as immunity gaps widen. Outbreaks have already been reported in several localities, with a growing risk of large-scale transmission in overcrowded camps and remote communities. Measles vaccine coverage has dropped 46%, and routine immunization, as measured by the first dose of diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis vaccine, the DTP1, fell to just 48% in 2024, threatening decades of progress in child health. The situation is especially alarming in the Darfur states, where thousands of children are missing out on life-saving vaccines due to insecurity, displacement, and limited access to health facilities. Persistent access challenges, including roadblocks and ongoing violence, continue to hamper efforts to deliver essential health services to the most vulnerable children. And there is another dimension to this crisis that we cannot ignore. Sexual violence is being used as a weapon of war. Millions of children are at risk of rape. Survivors include children as young as 1 year old. Behind every one of these numbers is a child, frightened, hungry, sick, and wondering why the world has not come to help. Despite extraordinary insecurity and access constraints, UNICEF and partners continue to deliver life-saving assistance wherever we can. We are treating severe acute malnutrition, severe malnutrition. We're vaccinating children against deadly diseases. In fact, we started a vaccination campaign in the Darfur this week. We are providing safe water and protection services to those affected by violence and displacement. These efforts are keeping children alive. But let me be clear, they are not enough. Humanitarian action can save lives, but it cannot replace the protection that only peace can provide. UNICEF is urgently calling for an immediate end to the fighting. All parties must uphold their obligation under international humanitarian law, protect civilians, stop attacks on hospitals, schools, and water systems, and allow safe, sustained, and unimpeded access across Sudan. Children in Sudan are not statistics. They're frightened, displaced, and hungry, but they're also determined, resourceful, and resilient. Every day, they strive to learn, to play, to hope, even as they wait for the world to act. Ending this conflict is not a political ask. It is a moral necessity. 1,000 days is far too long. Children cannot wait. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ricardo and Jens. Questions in the room? I don't see any hand up. Let me see on the platform. Nick?
Yeah, sorry. Good morning. Thanks for taking my question. A couple of questions to Jens, please. I wonder if you know, can just say, when was Kidugli cut off? How long has that been completely isolated? And what is the level of access for UN agencies at the moment to El Fasher? And the third question is, I mean, Sudan is one of the 17 countries that is supposed to be receiving assistance from the United States under the $2 billion that were announced at the end of last year. What is the status of the discussions about an MOU for providing aid to Sudan? Is any funding actually coming through at this point from the United States? Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. Let me take it in reverse order. Indeed, Sudan is one of the countries that will benefit from the $2 billion announcement that was made recently from the United States. As you know, the memorandum of understanding that kind of guides this allocation is a framework agreement, and that will then be replicated in the individual countries, including Sudan, with MOUs specifically for the money going to that crisis. In fact, we are looking at Sudan as the first country to create such an MOU with the Americans for their allocation. So trying to push that particular crisis to the forefront for this allocation. So that was the first thing. Access to El Fasher is still heavily constrained. I'll have to look up what exactly is the status of today, but it's not where it needs to be. The same for the exact date from when Kadugli is considered under siege. I'll have to look that up as well. But both what Kadugli is, as of today, remains under siege, and we can't respond as we should. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll go to Olivia.
Thank you. Morning, all. Thank you for this briefing. Two questions, if I may. Jens, you said hunger is becoming increasingly gendered. Can you explain why that is? And you mentioned many female-headed households, three-quarters, in fact, are reporting not having enough to eat. Can you just give the figure for how many female-headed households there are in Sudan? Thank you. And second question, is the UN planning another visit to El Fasher? I know there was one for a few hours in December. Are there any plans for a further visit this month? Thank you.
Thank you, Olivia. I didn't hear your first question, but maybe you can repeat that after. But let me take the second one. We cannot say for sure how many female-headed households there are exactly in the entire country of Sudan. We don't know. I don't think anyone knows that. But what we can do is that we can survey particular groups within the country, and then we can make statistics out of that. And that is what we are doing. And that's where we for example, can conclude that female-headed households are three times more likely to be food insecure than those households led by men. And that's what I mean by that the hunger situation is increasingly gendered. So that is kind of a snapshot. It may be you may be able to extrapolate to the entire country, but statistically we cannot do that at the moment. And if you could repeat the first question, please.
Yes, it was just wanting an explanation as to why that is, why you're seeing women, female-led households being more likely to be going without food. And the other part was, is the UN planning another visit to El Fasher after the one in December?
Yeah, on the visit, I don't have anything on my agenda, but that may change very quickly. And if there is a visit coming up, of course, we will inform you about that. Why female-headed households are particularly vulnerable, I think there's a complex background to that. We see that in very many crises. There may be pre-existing, how can I frame it, cultural conditions that make women-headed households fragile and vulnerable in the first place, even in the absence of a war. But what happens when conflict and war erupts, everything that's bad already gets worse. That's kind of the general picture of it. So you may have a country where women do not enjoy equality. When conflict breaks out, that inequality increases. It is, you know, it happens every single time, unfortunately. And of course, we should do everything we can to fight that. And that's why when we talk about a push for funding, we point specifically to female and women-led organizations, because they do, of course, have special knowledge, special access, particular understanding of what these household needs. So it's very important that these particular frontline women-led NGOs are supported.
Thank you. Other questions on Sudan? Yes, Boris?
Boris Engelson, a local freelancer. Don't take my question ill. I find the answers you give to the question of my colleagues quite enlightening. But what in the initial lengthy statement we heard, what didn't the world or self already know?
One of the tragedies of the crisis in Sudan is that we have been talking about it since day one, for 1,000 days now. So hopefully, I would say, there's nothing new in my statement, because these are things that we have repeated again and again. The problem is that we have not seen the action that should be taken to address this from the international community in terms of peacemaking, in terms of funding for our response, in terms of support to getting the access that we need. So for as long as this continues, we will treat it as a high priority, and that's what we brief about in these briefings, our high priority crisis.
Thank you very much. I don't see other questions on Sudan, so thanks. I'd like to thank Mr. Ricardo. Ask Marta to come to the podium, and while she is coming and speaking about children and human rights, just to inform you that we have the first committee of the year, the Committee on the Rights of the Child, which will open next Monday morning at 10 a.m. is 100th session. That will last until the 30th of January at Palais Wilson. The countries that they will review under this session are Maldives, Ghana, Uganda, Pakistan, Ethiopia, Colombia, Spain, and Malaysia. So we will remind you these countries while they come under review. And this has given Marta the time to sit down, and I'll invite her to start her briefing on Uganda and the concerns about the elections which are upcoming.
Good morning, everyone. Next week's elections in Uganda will take place in an environment marked by widespread repression and intimidation against the political opposition, human rights defenders, journalists, and those with dissenting voices, says a report that we have published today. It says Ugandan authorities have used a series of laws enacted or amended since the last election in 2021, entrenching repression and impunity, particularly against the opposition, and restricting the rights to freedom of expression, association, and peaceful assembly ahead of the 15 January presidential and parliamentary elections. High Commissioner Volker Turk calls on the Ugandan authorities to uphold the rights of all Ugandans to take part in the public affairs of the country fully and safely, and is their right under international law. They must, among others, ensure that no unnecessary or disproportionate force, including lethal force, is used to disperse peaceful protest on election day and beyond. Ugandan authorities have arrested and detained opposition leaders and activists, raided the premises of political opposition parties, and confiscated their property. They have also suspended radio stations, arrested bloggers, and tightened control over NGOs. Leading an opposition figure, Kizza Besigye, remains in detention on questionable treason charges since he was abducted in neighboring Kenya in November 2024. He and his associate, Ubeid Lutale, have been repeatedly denied bail on unclear grounds. The recent arrest of renowned human rights defender Sara Birete and the government's directive imposing a blanket ban on live broadcasting of what it describes as riots and unlawful processions are the latest in a series of concerning developments. The security forces, including police, the military, and the Joint Anti-Terrorist Task Force, have unlawfully used firearms and live ammunition to disperse peaceful assemblies and to carry out arbitrary arrests and prolonged pretrial detentions, particularly targeting the opposition, after using unmarked vans, commonly known as drones, to abduct opposition parties' members and supporters and hold them in incommunicado detention at unauthorized sites known as safe houses. All those responsible for election-related human rights violations, including unresolved violations from the 2021 elections, must be held to account through fair proceedings following effective, thorough, and impartial investigations. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marta. Questions on Uganda, the electoral process? I don't see any hand up. Am I right? Yep. Okay. So thank you very much, Marta. And actually, I have read you the announcement that I had. So I think this concludes this briefing. And I thank you very much for following it, and have a nice weekend. We'll see each other on Tuesday next week. Thank you.